Hi, I'm Tess Weglund. People have lost big money in this downturn. A lot of it was in accounts they thought would take them through the golden years. Those 401ks, have you ever looked at yours so much? Well, with 401ks rapidly shrinking into 301ks or, God forbid, 1ks, maybe it's time for a retirement system makeover.
For most people, the 401k system is a failed experiment.
We'll explore some of the options for a new retirement. Another experiment, subprime mortgages, stuck a lot of folks with house payments way beyond their means. For those who manage to refi to a fixed-rate loan, it's a whole new world.
They could never touch it again. Nothing could move. 20 years from now, I'll still be paying the same price.
And yes, there are some banks that seem willing to help. That story and more coming up as we continue our coverage of fallout from the financial crisis on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. Hard to believe, but a couple hundred more points off the Dow, and we'll be at 7,000. 50% decline from its high of last October. That means unless you're a mad genius, there is no way you haven't lost money in your 401k. Something's wrong with this picture. I'm Tess Weglund. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com.
Around September, 401k account balances became a national obsession. Millions of us have watched the money we invested for retirement evaporate as the markets went over a cliff. The S&P 500 is at its lowest level since 1997. The Dow has lost almost half its value in just over a year. These private accounts were never meant to be the backbone of our retirement system. They were designed as an add-on for wealthy executives. But, of course, over the past 20 years or so, they've become the default with very little government regulation. And now, these 401ks are getting a tough and some say overdue second look. Mark Every heads the Retirement Security Project at the Brookings Institution. Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be with you.
Why is this the time to reform the 401k system, if it is?
This is the time to reform the 401k system, but I would emphasize not to replace it. We need to step back and recognize that the 401k is a saving vehicle, not an investment strategy. It can accommodate aggressive or conservative investments. When the market was rewarding, naturally the emphasis has been on people not missing out, not excluding the average American from the potential growth that would provide a more adequate retirement. Now, with the events of the last few months, naturally the concern has shifted more to protecting the average American from the risk of catastrophic losses in their retirement savings.
Is there really any retirement system that would be safe when it's pegged to the stock market?
Well, in the traditional pension system, as in a 401k, if one wants to invest in a conservative way, there can be a guarantee of a particular return with a minimal risk of loss. The key is not really what type of plan. The key is what type of investment.
But the old pension system, you were guaranteed. You knew exactly what you were going to have.
When you look beneath the surface, it's not really that one of them guarantees an adequate retirement and the other doesn't. Ultimately, both of them are investing in the market. The traditional defined benefit plans now, for example, that have lost asset values in this current market are in need of immediate help from Congress so that employers will be willing to continue them. But without any particular help, we would see employees in those plans being exposed to the risk that the employer will simply stop the plan, will freeze it.
So what ideas do you see gaining traction in the Congress and also in the incoming administration?
Let me mention two in particular. Number one, the tax system is not structured in a way that benefits the majority of Americans. Mm-hmm. The higher our tax bracket, the greater the benefit, the greater the incentive to save. The lower our tax bracket, the less our financial incentive. That's obviously a very backward structure. And the answer is a credit. If you add a credit, let's say, at the rate of 50% of the amount they save, up to some modest amount, you are really giving people a meaningful financial incentive to save for the first time. A second key initiative that I think will get traction is the automatic IRA. We are in a position to be able to reform the 401k in a way that effectively extends the essentials of the 401k to 78 million working Americans. Employers that are not ready to sponsor a 401k or a defined benefit plan would simply let employees save the employee's own money by payroll deposit into an IRA. The employee would automatically be enrolled. They could opt out if they wanted to, and the employer would not incur any out-of-pocket cost, but would be a go-between forwarding the employee's money to the employee's IRA.
Mark Ivry is with the Retirement Security Project and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Thanks so much.
Good to be with you.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation, online at kauffman.org.
We're going to continue our discussion now of the 401k system. Teresa Ghilarducci is an economist with the New School in New York. And Teresa, with pensions, the so-called defined benefit system, your company sets aside money and you know what you're getting in return. With 401ks, you put the money in voluntarily and then you kind of cross your fingers that you're going to invest correctly and have something in the end. Your return depends on the markets.
There's actually another thing it depends upon. You don't actually get to survey the whole market and decide where to invest. You can only invest in the places that your employer has chosen for you. We're also finding that there's often a conflict of interest between the firm's loyalty to you and the firm's loyalty to the financial firms that they choose. The other problem is that most people withdraw money from their 401k plan before retirement. And worse, many employees think that employers are required to contribute to 401k plans, but in fact, it's only voluntary from the employer's point of view.
Given that we've seen a massive shift from the pension system to the 401k system, do either of them provide enough retirement income with of course, the add-on of Social Security?
That's a good question. If you have a defined benefit plan and you work for a company at about age 40 and you keep it until you retire, the defined benefit plan, the traditional pension plan, and Social Security will give you enough. The 401k plan is now a little under $100,000 on average for someone approaching retirement. That, for a average earner, will not give you enough with Social Security to replace your income. And so I've declared, for most people, the 401k system is a failed experiment.
You called 401ks a failed experiment. Is that fair, given that they've really only been popular since the 90s?
Yes, it is fair, because the projections of what they can do are really based on our observations of human behavior. Most experts are convinced that people will withdraw the money from their 401ks before they retire. And if they do that and only save at the extent that they are saving, 5-10%, they'll never be able to supplement Social Security to provide an adequate retirement savings.
Well, you've proposed a new retirement system that you argue combines kind of the best parts of a pension and the best parts of a 401k. Describe for us how it would work.
What I've proposed is an expansion of the Social Security system with a twist. I propose that at minimum, people contribute 5% with perhaps some help from their employer. That money would be invested by the government in stocks and bonds and other assets. And in return for their contributions, the federal government would guarantee 3% adjusted for inflation. So for today, it would be about 7% guaranteed return. And everybody I've talked to said that they would jump at that chance to earn 7% return on their 401k plan, given what they've just gone through, which is a negative 22% at best return on their income.
Teresa Ghilarducci is professor of economic policy analysis at the New School for Social Research in New York. And her book, When I'm 64, The Plot Against Pensions and the Plan to Save Them, came out this year. Thanks so much for your help today.
Thanks, Tess. It was an honor to be with you.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. It's time for the audio op-ed we call The Straight Story. And with me, as always, is our friend and economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Tess.
So, as you know, we've just been talking with a couple of folks about some of the issues that are coming up now that our 401ks and 403bs are shrinking most rapidly.
Yes. Vaporizing, I think.
Vaporizing. That's an excellent term for it. And, you know, I wondered if you wanted to weigh in on this. I mean, this is a system that hasn't been around for that long, and it certainly doesn't sound like it was designed to be, you know, the mainstay for our retirements. What do you think of the system at this point?
Well, I agree with the statement that was said earlier that the 401k system has failed.
Yeah.
And think about it, Tess. This is the second time in 8 years that we've had a major market meltdown. And we're building a retirement system around this. And it's the wrong way to think about retirement. What is it that we're really doing? We're buying an insurance policy and we're paying those premiums today. We call that savings, but we're buying an insurance policy so that our standard of living doesn't fall when we're older and we're no longer working or we're working less. I think we do need major reform.
All right. Well, we've heard a couple of opinions on what that reform should be. What's your take?
Okay, so I'm going to give you my three-part take. The first part is just very simple, and let's just do this right now. Can you explain to me why, if I stayed at home raising the kids, I can save $5,000 in an IRA, right?
Right.
Then I go work for a small company, has a simple IRA, I can put aside $10,500. Go work for another company, they have a 401k, it's $15,500. Can you explain to me why these differences exist?
No, I cannot.
No one can. No one can. Let's get rid of it. Let's have one rule, one regulation, one idea. I don't know what you want it, 15% of income, 20% of income, whatever number you come up with. If you want to save your retirement, we're an aging population, this is a social goal. Let's make it simple.
Well, the question I've always asked, though, if just to interrupt very quickly, is why should there be any limit on what you can save for retirement? I've never understood that myself.
I'm fine with that. Secondly, it's been an idea. It's been around for a long time. In the waning years of the Carter administration, there was a proposal about using the Social Security system and putting a supplementary system above that. So right. You include everybody.
Chris, that sounds a lot like what we heard just a few minutes ago from Teresa Ghilarducci, basically adding something to supplement Social Security.
That's right. That's the key idea. And then we might differ on the mechanics of that
right.
And where the investment money goes. But the idea, it's the same. And this is where I've been heavily influenced by Zvi Vodi, Boston University. Let's put those retirement savings in the Treasury inflation-protected securities. So 30 years from now, you know you're going to have this money. You've locked in your savings. And then above that, you want to put in the markets? That's fine. I don't have a problem with your doing that.
Okay. You think that's ever going to happen, my friend?
You know, Tess, I'm usually an optimist. But on this one, I'm not making any short-term bets. Let's put it that way.
All right. Our own Chris Farrell. Thanks so much, Chris, and we'll talk to you later in the show with a little getting personal.
Thanks.
An online degree can save you from the complications of traditional campus life.
Driving downtown 3, 4, 5 times a week, figuring out childcare at all different hours.
But does a value education get you value on the job market? The answer is coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. This week, Regents for the nation's largest public university system delivered some bad news to high school seniors. The California State University System says it's cutting 10,000 spots from its 23 campuses. Its sister system, the UC schools, warned it may have to limit freshman enrollment next fall if the state continues to cut funding. Even the Ivy Leagues have announced hiring freezes and budget cuts. But for one sector of the higher education universe, enrollments are booming, in part because they're easier on students' bottom lines. Mitchell Hartman reports from the Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting.
I'm in Kim Reed's classroom.
What does the doggy say?
Okay, actually, I'm in Kim Reed's kitchen, which is just one of the rooms around the house where she works on her degree, online, whenever she can.
It's little spurts. The most I have is 3 hours. There's one day a week I have 3 hours. Other times it's anything from half an hour to an hour.
Reed is 36. She has three kids, one still in diapers. She gives piano lessons. She sings with a band. And this fall, she started a full-time master's program through Emporia State University in Kansas. She wants to be a librarian. In this distance learning program, she meets with fellow students in Portland one weekend a month. She does the rest of her work by computer.
I had tried some traditional graduate programs, and I wasn't impressed enough to make that commitment of driving downtown 3, 4, 5 times a week, figuring out childcare at all different hours, and everything clicked with this program.
Students like Kim Reed have pushed online enrollments up 20% a year on average since 2002. A report from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation finds that nearly one in four students do some classes online. Elaine Allen heads up research at Babson College in Boston. She's co-author of that Sloan Foundation study. She says schools report enrollments rising even faster than expected this year.
Upwards of three-quarters of them say that students choose to take an online course because they're either being downsized or they're unemployed, and this is a way to improve their job skills, or because fuel costs are so high, they don't want to drive to campus.
Not many of Dan Veeley's students drive to class. Veeley directs online programs at Webster University in St. Louis. He says web-based programs appeal to mature students who have to find a way to balance study with paying the bills. But he says don't mistake convenience and easy access for just plain easy.
The difference in online is that class will begin perhaps Monday morning, and it will continue through Sunday night. And during that week, there'll be multiple interactions between the students in the class and the instructor with discussion topics, with assignments, with quizzes and assessment activities.
Veeley has an eclectic mix of students. The Japanese doctor who started an MBA degree in San Diego but could only finish it back in Japan by doing it online.
In that same class, I had the wife of a military serviceman who was stationed in Bogota, Colombia. But I also had a marketing vice president from Heineken in the Netherlands, and the rest were scattered around the U.S., many of which were out of the military installations.
Online education isn't for everyone, of course. Dan Veeley says you have to be disciplined to keep up with the work. Maybe that's why attrition rates are higher among online students. And he says for students who are struggling, math-heavy subjects like finance and accounting are often better taught in person. Kim Reed says she really likes people and misses the buzz of interacting with her fellow students face-to-face, but she sees the upside.
I'm pretty sure I'm going to have a decent job when I'm done, and I don't have to start paying my loans until 6 months after I graduate, and my loans are subsidized, so I feel pretty good about it.
And she's got time to let the current economic turmoil play itself out. She won't be knocking on library doors for a job until at least 2010. In Portland, I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace Money.
Graduates clutching online degrees have to compete with job seekers from actual halls of learning. Polls show employers don't think distance learning is on par with traditional college. Yet, the gap is shrinking, according to pollster John Zogby. His new book, The Way Will Be, predicts that online education will become a way of life. Thanks for being here.
Hey, Tess, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. So in your book, you compare online college degrees to the trend of flex cars, which are like timeshares for cars. Explain for us what the overlap is.
It's all part of a new paradigm, you know, where Americans, in many ways from the bottom up, are creating new and more flexible institutions. And so in a world where more and more Americans are seeking advanced degrees or college degrees or certificate courses, they're also working for 40, 50, and 60 hours a week in the workplace and have other responsibilities as well. And so here come the online universities to offer very busy people the option of improving themselves with an education.
The obvious benefits are that, you know, you can adapt it to your schedule. It's most likely cheaper. You don't have to kind of pick up and move somewhere to a campus. But there must be trade-offs here as well.
I mean, right now, to be very honest, online education is not viewed with the same level of respect by professionals, by academics, by business leaders. In fact, for that matter, even the students themselves, the same way that a traditional brick-and-mortar education is. I can tell you purely anecdotally, you know, that as an employer, I have people with master's degrees from both very, very good top universities in this country and also those who have gotten online degrees. And in many instances, the people are very, very good. In a few instances, I would have to admit that some of the ones with online degrees, not as advanced as those with brick and mortar. But we have reason to believe from the polling that we have done over the last couple of years that the level of acceptance for the online degree is growing.
I wonder if there's any guidance in terms of what these online institutions have to do to make themselves more viable, more understood, more relevant.
It's going to be very difficult to have a virtual football team now, isn't it?
Right.
Or for that matter, fans. But, you know, you're going to see all-out efforts at recruiting stars. You know, star faculty, star authors, genuine experts in the field of research and so on, which in fact then draws the best students. And problems, as I mentioned earlier, iron themselves out. Members of the old paradigm, public universities, major public universities, decide this is the wave of our future. And we can bring students in at a much lower overhead and offer them a very good education, and they have the skills and the technology to do it all at home.
John Zogby's latest book is The Way Will Be, the Zogby Report on the Transformation of the American Dream. And he's been chatting with us about the value of online educations. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks so much, Tess.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com. And by CSX, whose trains move a ton of freight 423 miles on 1 gallon of fuel to help reduce emissions. CSX, how tomorrow moves. And by saveandinvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence by providing unbiased financial information, tools, and more online at saveandinvest.org.
It is time for Getting Personal, the part of the show where we answer your questions. And here with me once again is our personal finance expert, Chris Farrell. Hello again, Chris.
Hello, Tess, and welcome back.
Well, thank you very much. I am tanned, rested, and ready.
Excellent. Excellent. That's what a vacation is supposed to do.
Yeah, all three of those except tanned, but got to protect the skin. Anyway, let's go ahead and hit the phones. And first, we've got Daniel on the line in Vallejo, California. Hi, Daniel.
Hi there.
So I understand you are living without any heat, which doesn't tend to be a problem this time of year in California, but you'd like to have it available to you. What happened?
You know, I bought a house from Wachovia. It was a foreclosure. It had some mold damage, toxic mold, And before we actually closed on the house, we agreed with Wachovia that they would clean it up. So, yeah, we were there for a few weeks with no hot water. That was rather cold. And now we're there without heat. You know, we can buy space heaters and such. But this is all happening because Wachovia decided, hey, we didn't want to pay this much. And so they decided not to pay the contractor.
Was the amount different from whatever estimate they were given?
Yeah. The original estimate was about $15,000. And they're now in for about, I want to say,
$88,000. Whoa!
Okay.
So Wachovia doesn't want to pay the bill.
Right. But I'm worried about, you know, the contractor coming back to us and saying, hey, look, you're an asset holder here. We can take your house.
I'd be worried, too. I'm not an expert in contract law, but if I were in your situation, I'd be doing two things. One, and the most important, is the real estate lawyer. And the other is, quite frankly, I'd contact in California's a very aggressive state attorney general's office and say, look, you know, this is wrong the way it's being handled. But your main line of protection is a lawyer that is going to advocate for you, but also understands real estate law, contract law, and foreclosures.
You know, if I wanted to walk away and sell the house, you know, what are my options there?
I've been disturbed by some of these stories that I've been hearing, people saying, you know, they made all this money buying in foreclosure and how great it's been. But the stories that I'm getting are much more along the lines of your experience. And in fact, I know somebody who just bailed out of a foreclosed home, just put a little bit of money down, but then realized what a difficult situation that he had entered into, and he just got himself out of there. But also, you have a little bit of the environment is behind you. I mean, one of the things that has really changed on the state level, the federal level, the banking level is, you know, they don't want people walking away from these homes because that's the worst for everybody. A year ago, they would have said, you know, we don't care about you and, you know, here's the deal. In the current environment that we're in, I think you have a little more negotiating leeway.
So good luck and let us know what happens, would you?
Absolutely. Thanks so much.
All right, Chris, next we have an email from Anne, and she too is here in California, right here in Los Angeles, and she wants to get out of some risky investments. She writes that for many years she had a small brokerage account with A.G. Edwards. She's guessing it has about $40,000 in it today, but she doesn't really know. She's too afraid to look. Very familiar story for many of us.
I was just going to say, we're getting that email and that a lot, yes.
She feels like she's too small a fish to have a brokerage account anymore, so she's looking to put the money possibly in an index fund. But she's afraid if she sells the stocks, she's going to lose money. So how can she change the way the money is invested without losing some of it? Is that possible?
You know, Tess, there's actually a lot mixed into this question. One is going from a brokerage account where there's a lot of buying and selling going on in the portfolio, and then going into an equity index fund where you're not paying that professional money manager. You're buying whatever the market's going to do, right? But there's another question, I think, in this, don't you, which is, should be as much in stocks as she is? Should she be thinking about some other investments? So I'm going to give a sort of stages of investing during this traumatic time. One is I would do, okay, let's find your equity index fund first. Do you want to put this, all of it, into an equity index fund? Maybe you should be only a portion in equity index fund and the rest in bonds. Maybe you want to be in government bonds, even though you're not getting much of a return. So find your fund, figure out how much you want to put into equities, how much you want to put into bonds. And then I would say, over a period of time, I'll make the maneuver. Set up your program and then do it over a period of time. Don't lock in your losses at this point in time, but set up your new investment program during this period of time so you know where you're going.
So you're saying essentially that she should hold on to these stocks that have depreciated so greatly and in the meantime open up a new account where she can take advantage of index funds, but wait for those stocks to, we hope, inevitably come back?
Or at least come back enough. But boy, it really is a time to figure out, okay, where do I really want that money to go? And I am a little bit with this email. I'm not completely convinced that she wants to keep all that money in equities.
Okay. Well, you are certainly no small fish to us. Do leave us a voicemail with your questions anytime at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, and we spell that M-O-N-Y. Or write us an email. The Getting Personal link is at marketplace.org. And we'll be back with more Getting Personal later in the show. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Thanksgiving is right around the corner, so are you planning on going anywhere for the holiday? Well, according to AAA's annual survey, even though we're getting a break on gas prices, lots of you are staying put. Holiday travel is expected to drop for the first time in 6 years. Even so, 41 million people will travel by a plane, train, or automobile. If you're in that last group, give thanks for the man we're driving with on this week's A Day in the Work Life.
Hi, my name is Rick Fremont. I'm 51 years old, and I'm the guy that paints the lines on America's highways. I've been painting lines 30 years. It takes about 17 gallons for a double yellow line a mile long down the road. We use many different types of paints, waterborne, epoxy. You can't buy this stuff at Home Depot. A typical day is that there's no typical day. We work days, we work nights, we're very weather dependent. We have to adhere to a lot of lane closure schedules and contractor requests and state requests. I drive a 1,000-gallon epoxy truck that holds 1,000 gallons of epoxy resin and hardener and 12,000 pounds of glass beads. Without glass beads, you wouldn't be able to see the lines at night. It's called the principle of retroreflectivity, where the light from your headlights enters the glass that's embedded in the line, picks up the color, and returns to you. Great. Nationwide, there's only 300 contractors that actually own striping trucks. It's a very, very small industry. Striping trucks today can cost up to $700,000. I don't have any clothes with stripes on them, but I have a lot of clothes with paint on them. The crew I run is actually 10 people. Three of those are on the paint truck itself, and the rest are providing traffic control behind us. Once in a while, a moron will drive over the wet line, and he tracks the paint and gets it on his car, and puts a claim in against us for getting paint on his car. People in the line striping industry can make anywhere from $50,000 to $150,000 a year. As you're driving down an interstate highway, how long are the skip lines in the middle of the road? Everybody always gets this wrong. The answer is 10 foot long. Yeah, I do consider myself an artist. My paintbrush weighs 60,000 pounds, and I think that there's a certain degree of artistic ability that is inherent in driving a truck straight and around the curves and all that. I don't draw lines in my sleep, but when I cut my lawn, I try to go straight.
That was asphalt artiste Rick Fremont. A Day in the Work Life was reported by Wally Nichols. Most of the news out of the financial meltdown has generated tears, cries of agony, maybe even a few screams of frustration, but shouts of joy?
My interest rate went down to 5.25, and I just started screaming.
Mortgage workouts and a whole lot more up next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac delivered an early holiday gift to some troubled homeowners this week. The two mortgage finance giants, which are currently under government control, announced they're suspending all evictions until January 9th. Foreclosures spiked 25% in October over the same time last year. While more are no doubt on the way, some lenders are trying to modify loans to keep people in their homes. As we continue our coverage of the fallout from the financial crisis, Jess Mador reports from Minnesota Public Radio on some of those efforts.
Janice Davis still gets emotional when she remembers the day she got the letter telling her her mortgage payment would go down.
I opened it. I started screaming, and it was like my interest rate went down to 5.25, and I just started screaming.
Like many homeowners over the past few years, Davis refinanced her South Minneapolis home with an adjustable rate mortgage. From the start, it had a high interest rate that she couldn't afford. She says she knew it was risky, but she didn't really understand how risky.
The interest rate, the principal, all this stuff, and you know nothing about it. You don't go to nobody's office. You don't have a lawyer. They come to your house and they got to get to the next appointment. So if they go, well, we just sign them, then I'll explain them all to you. By then, you'll be all forgot the questions you're going to ask.
To add to the confusion, her mortgage broker promised she'd be able to lower her payments in the future by simply refinancing again. As the interest rate went up and up, Davis, who works as a baggage handler at Northwest Airlines, quickly fell behind, and she couldn't get a new loan. Eventually, she went into foreclosure. For a year, her lender, Countrywide, repeatedly denied her requests for a modification. But this past July, to Davis's amazement, Countrywide dropped her interest rate from 10% down to 5.25%. That lowered her monthly payment by $400. And the best part? It's a fixed rate.
They could never touch it again. Nothing can move. 20 years from now, I'll still be paying the same price.
Stories like Davis's are happening nationwide. There were 79,000 loan modifications in August, triple what it was last year. That's because home foreclosures are expensive for everyone involved. Each default costs lenders an estimated $40,000, plus the additional cost of putting the house back on the market. Rick Simon from Bank of America says the lender started taking a different approach to foreclosures about a year ago, shortly before it bought Countrywide.
If we can anticipate we're going to have these increases in foreclosure rates, the thinking now is more and more, why don't you take some of that cost and move it forward and put it toward home retention?
Simon says Bank of America has modified four times as many loans as it did last year, and the banking industry as a whole is more willing to lower principal and interest rates for borrowers. In the past, that was rare because a strong housing market made it easy for homeowners to refinance or sell. That was before credit tightened and home values plummeted. Joe O'Hayen from Wells Fargo Home Mortgage says it's true, lenders are more willing to give modifications, but he says every struggling homeowner won't qualify.
It's really based off the borrower's ability to pay. We want to make sure we put them into a payment that's affordable and sustainable. We don't want to have a redefault in the following cycle.
He says even in the foreclosure crisis, lenders have to meet standards that also serve the goals of their investors. Looking back, homeowner Janice Davis says she shouldn't have accepted an adjustable rate mortgage on the house she's lived in for 14 years. But now that her interest rate is fixed at a level she can afford, Davis says her struggle was worth it.
It feels good now to be able to pay your mortgage.
But Davis is one of the lucky ones. A record number of homeowners are behind on their mortgage payments, and more than 4 million Americans are expected to foreclose over the next 2 years. In Minneapolis, I'm Jess Mador for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com. By Gather.com, if it's happening in the world, it's being discussed on Gather. People are talking about the economy at Gather.com. And by CSX, whose trains move a ton of freight 423 miles on 1 gallon of fuel to help reduce emissions. CSX, how tomorrow moves.
We're back with more Getting Personal, and Chris is back with us as well. Chris, let's go ahead and hit the phones. Jerry is with us from Berkeley, California. Hi, Jerry.
Hi.
What's your question for Chris today?
It's a question about health insurance and my mother. She's a waitress, and she's not provided health care by her employer. And so I've been paying for an individual account through Blue Cross for her, and I was wondering if there's any tax benefit to me for providing health care to my mother.
Good question. This is something that he's doing for his mother, so it's not his health care. Is that something that he can deduct on his taxes?
He may be able to take it off on his taxes, but probably not, because you still have to leap that hurdle of 7.5% of your adjusted gross income going toward medical expenses.
To have a health care deduction.
Right. But I think this is a very big and important issue, because at what point can you claim your elderly parent as a dependent? And there are several tests that the government has. For example, this filing year, I believe the figure was the parent couldn't earn more than $3,400 in taxable income. The other test that's very important is that the parent has to get one half of their support from the adult child.
Jerry, how old is your mother?
She's 56.
56, so she's still fairly young.
That's right. So for you at this point in time, it's not going to work. But I have a couple recommendations, Jerry. One is that I would actually go, if you have an accountant, just to sort of run through the numbers. At what point does this start kicking in? It may be something that you want to just be more aware of. But are there other issues that you want to start working with her on in terms of long-term retirement, whether it be long-term care insurance, you know, her retirement income, some of those bigger questions about getting older and nearing your retirement years?
But for now, in terms of him paying for his mom's health insurance, he's probably not going to get a break from Uncle Sam.
Probably not. I would still run the numbers. I would see. But all indications are the answer is no. But the question that I'd want to, assuming that the answer is no, what are the trigger points where it might change?
And that would be for making his mother one of his dependents.
That's right. Which is how you get the tax break.
Does that help you out, Jerry?
It does. It does, I suppose. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks so much.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right, Chris, let's reach into the email bag. And, you know, there is a whole lot of talk these days about retirement.
Oh, you are a master of the understatement there.
Oh, thank you so much. That's what I do well. We got an email from Fred in Providence, Rhode Island, who has heard that a good time to move funds from a traditional IRA to a Roth IRA is when the stock market is down. So he's wondering, is this true? And why? And if so, is this something that he should be doing?
It's something that everybody should be considering. Now, don't run out and just do it. You do need to run some numbers. You need to make sure that it makes sense for you. But here's the basic calculation. You have your traditional IRA, which is pre-tax dollars, right? And then when you withdraw that money during retirement, you pay your ordinary income tax on it. It's part of your income. With the Roth IRA, you put the money in, it's after tax, but then when you withdraw it during retirement, it's tax-free. Now, as long as your income is under, your adjusted gross income is under $100,000, you can convert part or all of your traditional IRA into a Roth. And the big kick there is that your earnings will be tax-free when you pull them out in retirement. The drawback is you have to pay the tax on your assets.
So this notion of doing it when the market is down is simply because your portfolio isn't worth as much, so you're not going to pay as much in taxes.
Exactly. Your tax hit is less. And remember, you can't do it if your income is over $100,000.
And you can't do it if you can't pay the tax on the rollover.
You know, you always raise these complications. I mean, really, you just had the – that's absolutely right. If you can't pay the tax, you don't do it.
All right, one more on retirement. Brian in McFarland, Wisconsin, recently wrote in to tell us that his employer has frozen his 403B account. How and why would an employer freeze the retirement account?
Well, Tess, there's a couple things going on, but one of them has to do with some changes to the 403B. And the new regulations kick in at the beginning of the new year, January 2009. And basically, if we're just going to boil it down, some differences between the 403B and the 401K have been eliminated.
The 403B is essentially the nonprofit version of a 401K.
Exactly. And for historic reasons, it's had some strange quirks, and they've been cleaned up and they've been straightened out. Now, why his employer has decided they no longer want to do this, I don't know. First thing, though, he should do is roll it over. Institution transfer, so we don't have any tax implications. So that's the real bottom line here. He needs to roll it over. The employer needs to say, here's the process on our end, how we do that. That is the employer's responsibility.
So he's not going to lose any money here. He's just no longer going to have a company-sponsored retirement plan, but he can take all of that money in the current account and roll it over into another one.
That's right. And shame on the employer for not offering their employees a retirement account. Now, hopefully, they're substituting something else and it's just not included in his email. But if they're dropping their retirement plan, shame on them.
All right. With that, unfortunately, that's all the time we've got for questions on this week's show. But you can call us anytime. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And you can also email us through the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. Chris, thanks as always for the good advice.
Thanks.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. For the last few weeks around Marketplace, we've been asking, what are you doing? Yes, you and others who are deciding what changes to make in how they manage their money during this time of turmoil. Today, we check in with a woman in Hickman, Nebraska.
My name's Julie Gansel Wilnard. I have a husband named Charlie and two kids. We started up two new businesses. My husband, he's doing farm appraisals and making crop insurance. And then we also have a farming operation. We used quite a bit of our emergency funds to start up those businesses. The funds we had in an account through our financial planner, which we now know was with Lehman Brothers. And now it's frozen. With our account now frozen, our bank will, of course, lend us the money, but that was our backup. And now it's our first defense, which is scary to us. That's money we worked really hard for. And the one institution that it happened to be with was the one the government didn't bail out. And that bothers me still a little. And then I remind myself, at the end of the day, we'll be okay. Even though we're really doing okay financially, we're saving a lot more now because we don't know what's going to happen in the future. I'm cutting coupons and save every dime and nickel. My husband's had a saying all our life, you take care of the pennies and nickels and the dollars take care of themselves.
Julie Wilnard of Hickman, Nebraska. And you can find more from our series at marketplace.org. Last week, we mentioned that stores are really going out of their way to attract shoppers this year. Big sales, generous return policies, ads telling you that, yes, we feel your pain during these tough economic times. I don't know about you. Feels a little desperate. We asked Ashley Milne-Tite to track down that desperation on the not-so-busy streets of New York.
This year, Macy's really is hoping for a miracle on 34th Street. For weeks, it's been trying to convince worried consumers to step in and spend. When I was there recently with retail consultant Wendy Liebman, prices on Macy's own clothing line were slashed by 40 to 70%. Even some luxury items like Coach handbags are 30% off. Liebman notices something else that's different this year. Easy-to-spot prices.
So all the gift sets with price signs right out front. Very boldly merchandise pricing, which you tend not to see. You usually figure out the gift is a certain value, but it's not so overtly signed.
The point, she says, is to signal an item's affordability right away. As for all those glitzy tops and dresses that usually lure customers around the holidays, they're not so much in evidence this year. Instead, more mundane pants and sweaters fill the racks.
You know, if people are buying today, they're tending to buy things that they can be pretty safe and sure with. Things that they're replacing as opposed to new special things.
At Target, spokesman Joshua Thomas is quick to say they always emphasize low prices, but the chain is not immune from consumer withdrawal. Its profit fell 24% in the third quarter.
Thomas says this holiday season, Target is taking some extra steps to connect the value dots for customers.
So the holiday toy catalog features coupons for toys that are on sale during the holiday season. And what we're doing is flagging those items within the store so there's a direct connection from the toy catalog to the product you actually see on the shelf.
But surely starting sales in early to mid-November, as most retailers have, doesn't bode well for their bottom lines. Since major retailers aren't eager to discuss that, I asked Amanda Nicholson, a retail professor at Syracuse University. Listen, are retailers going to make any money if they're doing all this price slashing?
Probably very little.
In fact, she says many smaller retailers could go out of business next year if customers hold back over the holidays. That's what Wendy Ginsberg is afraid of. She runs Verve, an accessory store in Greenwich Village selling handbags, hats and jewellery. She's just begun to stock some cheaper items like tiny wallets and keychains.
Whereas before people, literally, I would have customers come in and just give me their list. And we would go through the store and I would be able to pretty much hit everybody on their list at every price point. Now everybody on their list is at a very low price point.
Talking of low prices, many consumers see the web as a bargain hunter's paradise. Online sales are expected to rise this year. Again, retail professor Amanda Nicholson.
Retailers who have an online presence are working hard with things like free shipping, which I think they're going to hold off till that holiday crunch period and then start offering it like crazy.
On the flip side, Nicholson says, service at bricks and mortar establishments won't be so efficient. There'll be fewer holiday staff. Look forward to crazy lines at the checkout, she says, and be prepared to root through piles of discarded sweaters on your own. Still, a little entrepreneurial spirit could pay dividends this year. Standing outside Macy's on 34th Street, Wendy Liebman says some shoppers have decided desperate times call for daring tactics, like haggling.
So about 1 in 5 shoppers around the country are saying they are now brazen enough to go into a store and say, well, you've got 20% off, can you do any better for me? Or if I buy 2, can you do any better for me?
As for how often it works, Liebman says that depends on the store. She says wise retailers will give senior staff the authority to negotiate, although it's often easier to do a deal with a smaller store. It's worth a try, she says. Retailers will do a lot to accommodate you this Christmas. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace Money.
And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, as credit freezes up and Black Friday approaches, stores are bringing back an old school option. Say it with me now, layaway.
You could just see the light bulbs going on in their heads going, you know, this really makes a lot of sense.
Marketplace Money is produced by Jim Wallace with Stephen Hoffman, Eve Troh, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vinkland. Enjoy the holiday, and we'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the Internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com.
American Public Media.